and Workforce Development, and I will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 383. And Jeremy, please tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 383 permits home care worker who is a party in a Department of Human Services contested case hearing to be represented by a labor union representative, establishes labor union representative scope of representation. And I might add that the intention is to have them either represented by an attorney or a non-attorney from the union.
Looks like the bill has no revenue impact.
No revenue.
Still awaiting a fiscal
impact, and we do not yet have a fiscal.
Okay. And we have a panel of witnesses, so I will call Megan Moyer, Carla Spence, and Mark Steffen. Please, if the three of you would like to come forward. And I just want to remind the audience what you probably already know, that if you have a cell phone, which I bet you do, or a BlackBerry or any such thing, please turn it off because it does interfere with our recording equipment here. And please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm here representing SEIU Local 503 and the approximately 10,000 home care workers which we represent. Senate Bill 383 is a needed statutory change to address a situation that we encountered in 2005 where we found out that we had both a letter of agreement and OARs that were not in compliance with Oregon statute, and so this is a fix. What Senate Bill 383 does is it allows union representation of a home care worker in a contested case hearing, and for home care workers, contested case hearing is the process in which a home care worker is terminated and can no longer provide care. Now, this is not the same as a home care worker being terminated by a client employer. That is, they are an at-will employee of a client employer and can be terminated for any reason at any time. But this has to do with their ability to ever provide home care through the state or in other settings. Senate Bill 383 would give home care workers the same rights granted to many different parties in contested case hearings in other state agencies. ORS 183.457 grants the right to authorize representation in contested case hearings in departments such as the State Fire Marshal, Public Utility Commission, the Department of Agriculture, and the Bureau of Labor and Industry. It is our intention with Senate Bill 383 to extend that right in statute to home care workers as well.
Okay, I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from all of you, so if you would like to go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carla Spence, and I have been involved with home care workers since 1996. And when we bargained the first contract for home care workers, we recognized that the Home Care Commission was going to be directly responsible in some areas of implementing the contract that we bargained. But there was one area that DHS had to remain in control, and that's by virtue of the fact that they are a Medicaid agency. They have the right, and they have to exercise that right to determine who a Medicaid vendor is, and that also includes terminating provider numbers for home care workers. And as Megan said, we absolutely support a constitutional right that the consumer employer has to terminate their home care worker at any time for any reason. We believe that a home care worker a consumer should have the right to decide who comes into their private home. When the client-employer-employee relationship is terminated in that setting, the home care worker then goes on to find another consumer employer for whom to work, and the relationship as a home care worker is not terminated. When the provider number is terminated, they not only lose their ability to work for any client, They also lose the right to work in any other healthcare-related field that has a Medicaid component to it. So that would include adult foster homes, nursing homes, et cetera. So it really virtually ends their ability to be employed in the healthcare field. DHS and the union worked out an agreement in that first contract, and I would like to point you to an attachment that I presented. It's a January 3rd letter, January 3rd, 2003. And this agreement allowed home care workers the right to have union representation during the course of a proceeding to terminate their provider number. And DHS then adopted administrative rules to honor that agreement, and I was actually a part of that work group to adopt new rules to allow a process by which a home care worker could have a right to tell their side of the story in a termination. And I've also attached the administrative rules, and on page 22, it's on page 23. There is a site there that the home care workers' appeal rights, including the right to union representation, where to file the appeal, is present. Prior to this agreement, home care workers had no right to appeal a termination ever. They had no due process. When DHS made a decision to terminate their provider number, there was nowhere for them to go to tell their side of the story. The only time they could contest their termination is if there was a termination based on a criminal background check. That was the only time they could appeal. So from January 2003, when we entered into this letter of agreement, through the present, through today, we have only had one case that has gone to an administrative law judge setting. And so I think that speaks well to a process that has worked for both the home care worker and also for DHS. We've had an ability to have the worker tell their side of the story and to present additional information and evidence, and DHS has had better information with which to make a decision about whether that provider number should be terminated. So with only one case moving forward, we all thought we were doing pretty good. But then we had one case. And I want to tell you this story very briefly about this one case. Her name was Kathy Jordan. She had been a longtime home care worker. She was caring for a woman who needed 24-hour care. She had had a series of home care workers who did not work out very well for her. And Kathy was, in her words, the best caregiver she had ever had. During the Christmas season of 2004, Kathy invited this woman into her home because she didn't have any family or friends. And it ended up being an extended stay with her through January. She kept her apartment. She kept her dog at her apartment. She got her mail at her apartment. But she was at her caregiver's home for a period of about a month. DHS moved to terminate her provider number because she was operating an illegal adult foster home. And so we went through the whole process of fact-finding and all of the evidence. The client begged DHS to reverse the ruling. I begged DHS to reverse the ruling that there was no adult foster home. This woman had the right to go there and stay as a guest for a vacation. In fact, she said it was the best vacation she had ever had. She got to stay with a family and be with other little children and other people, and she did well. DHS declined to reverse their decision, and so we went on to the appeal process, and it was at the time we went to an administrative law judge, we were told that our attorney could not represent Kathy at this hearing because we weren't a party to the, because we could not we could not represent her because our attorney works for the union and not for the client. We did a lot of maneuvering around to be able to have access to be her attorney. She is a home care worker. She had no money. we finally did have the ability to represent her in that hearing, and she ultimately won her provider number back, but that was not until 2007. In the meantime, the client had to move on to another home care worker, which was really gut-wrenching for her. Kathy lost her home. She ran out of unemployment, and she lost a lot. And there is no back pay remedy for a home care worker going through this process. She didn't win a back pay award. And at the time of the hearing, we were told by DHS, presumably through DOJ, that the only way that we could do this in the future is if we could change the statute, and that's what we're here today to do. So I'm here to urge you to pass this bill and give home care workers the right that lots and lots of other people have before an administrative law judge, to have somebody there to advocate and represent them.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Steffen, and I'm House Counsel for SEIU Local 503. And actually, I want to keep my comments very short. Really, what we're the purpose of this bill, as Carla just mentioned, is really to allow the union to do for home care workers what we do for thousands of other people we represent in both the public and the private sector. And that's basically to provide them with representation in a proceeding that threatens them, in effect, with termination. It's a long-established process, again, in the public and private sector, in which the union, and through their attorneys, the relationship that exists between an attorney and a union and a grievant, or in this situation, someone who's subject to this hearing, is not really attorney-client. The attorney represents the union, and the union is there, and whether it's an attorney or it's another representative, they're there in a representational capacity. So it really doesn't invoke any kind of attorney-client situations that might exist in another situation. So, again, just to try to keep this simple, and I think it's legitimately a relatively simple question, is all we're trying to do here is afford these people representational rights by virtue of being someone who's represented by a labor organization, to allow them to do the same representation that any DAS employee or OUS or any public sector employee or private sector employee has, is if they're in a situation where they're being terminated, their union has the capacity to come in and represent them in that situation. And that's the sole purpose of the amendment to the bill, and we think it's obviously a good thing for employees to have that right and have that due process procedure available to them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for this panel of witnesses? Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. The way it is now, if a home care worker did get their own attorney, would the union pay for those services?
No.
Would you ever consider paying for those services?
We can't afford. That's why we have in-house attorneys.
Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions? Yes, Senator Prezanski.
I just want to put on the record, I've looked at the statute under 183.457, where it talks about where a person who's going through the contested case hearing has the right to an attorney, or as it says, or an authorized representative subject to the provisions of subsection 2. So, and what's on the record now is that currently we allow an individual who is faced with that type of hearing to choose or select an authorized representative. I didn't see a definition for authorized representative as it pertains to this portion of the statutes. I saw that term used in two or three other parts of the statutes, meaning all of the Oregon laws, and I'm wondering what's the limitation as to, or the definition of, who's authorized as representative for this type of proceeding under a contested case hearing versus who's not.
And what section is that you're reading from right now?
It's 183.457. Council or committee administrator has the text, and I just looked at it, and what I was trying to do is cross-reference what authorized representative means. I'm assuming, at least what I'm hearing here, it's basically if they have a union representing them, they could have a union rep come in and represent them. But does that mean if I wanted to have a relative come in, are they an authorized representative for me? I'm just trying to figure out what the parameters are of who actually gets to come in.
I'm not sure if you're referring to the statute as it exists or as it's amended.
Well, I think we're reading from the current statute,
yeah,
right?
That's correct.
My understanding of the interpretation has been that in a contested case hearing, unless you're the, at least in terms of attorneys, they require that you have a attorney-client relationship with the home care worker. So unless you sign some sort of retainer agreement or something of that nature, whether they would be allowed to bring some other quote-unquote representative in, I'm not entirely sure on that. In terms of the amendment, though, we want to have the objective is that it could either be an attorney or some other union agent.
Yeah. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Przanski, in ORS 183.457, that is or rights that are granted only to the listed agencies. So as you'll see, Department of Human Services is not a party to that statute, which is why for our purposes, Senate Bill 383 is very specific in the language of who can that person be. And it specifically says union representation, which can be either a union lawyer or a staff, other staff. I can't speak to this ORS, but that is our Senate Bill 383 is very clear of who is able to represent.
Well, I don't.
Go ahead.
I mean, I beg to differ with you just because when you first gave the statute out, I wrote it down and I looked at it. In the very first subsection one, it says that the person who's participating in a contested case hearing conducted by the agency described in this subsection, that's where you're talking about which ones actually you get to do it, has the right to have an attorney or by an authorized representative subject to the provisions in sub 2. And so when you look at sub 2, it's basically a test that the hearings officer applies to whether or not they're going to let this other person step in. My only concern is I'm not sure who is an authorized representative, and are we somehow needing to make certain that that's defined as compared to not being someone that's off the street coming in to be authorized, or what's the parameter there? I'm just trying to figure out, and it seems like it should be here. Maybe it is. This is the first I've heard of this.
I mean, I think that in defining whether somebody is an authorized rep, I would actually lay that in the hands of the person who's going to the hearing. If they want to have somebody other than the union, they certainly have the right to do that. What we're trying to do, and we have stewards, we have people, I mean, I could see myself going before an administrative law judge and helping a home care worker and advocating for them at that level. So we would use the term authorized representative fairly broadly and allow the home care worker to make that distinction.
Okay. So in other words, it sounds like it's a broader category, but in this case, because there is this letter of agreement, it's clear that the intention was to allow home care workers to have somebody from the union, whether it was a lawyer or not.
All right. I mean, if that's to me, if we're saying authorized representative means someone that's within the union bargaining group, that's fine.
I mean it's not inconsistent, sounds like. So, does that finish your line of thought?
At this point, yes.
Okay, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That really brings up an interesting question. Why not, in the bill, just amend 183.457 to simply include the Department of Human Services rather than add this other language?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, that was actually the original language we gave to Legislative Council, and the rationale that I actually had a conversation with Legislative Council. He called me about this issue, and his concern was that that would be broader than our intention and might have other ramifications, and he felt it would be most appropriate to write a bill that is very specific to our interests and not that. And I am not a lawyer, so I was fine with
Madam Chair.
Senator George, are you?
Oh, yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the difference here is that if you put it in as just for the agency, it opens up the agency to anything and everything they've got as compared to this, let's call it subset of what is before us in this bill.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that, any other questions? Okay, that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I make
one? And if you want to re-identify yourself,
my name is Carla Spence. I just wanted to also state for the record that when DHS entered into this letter of agreement with us in January 03, they did so in good faith. I think that neither party knew about this law until we actually went to that first hearing. So I just wanted to make sure that that was on the record as well.
Okay. Well, that actually completes our sign-up sheet. Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 383? Seeing no one.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
It would be nice to know where DHS comes, what they haven't signed up, correct?
They did not sign up. We know that they're aware of this bill, and apparently.
And they're actually in the room.
And they're here.
Okay, and then if there is a matter of difference of where this should be, if we need to have legislative council come.
Well, we can't work the bill today because we don't have the fiscal, and it looks like we do have someone just come forward. So please identify yourself. And
for the record, I'm Jeanette Burkett. I'm an administrator with the Office of Senior and Disability Services with the Division of Senior and People with Disabilities with the Department of Human Services. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'd just like to state for the record that SPD supports this bill. We find that the reason that you haven't received a fiscal on it is that essentially it's indeterminate because it's based upon the number of hearings that might come forth and the complexity related to them. The only fiscal would be related to the potential for us to consult more frequently with Department of Justice on our strategy and our preparation for a hearing. But as Carla Spence testified, our history over this will be starting the fourth biennium of our bargaining contract, and we have had one case go to contested case hearing. So I think we can reasonably say there wouldn't be a large fiscal.
Okay. Thank you very much for clarifying your position.
Certainly.
And, yes, Senator Pazansky.
Madam Chair, I just want to put on the record, if anyone's looking or following on the statutes, the following statute after the one that has been given to us, which is 183.458, there they actually talk about non-attorney representation and certain type of cases. So there they've actually gone into and defined. I'm just going to put on the record from what we're hearing from all the testimony is that when we see the term authorized representative, as it would pertain to these healthcare workers, home care workers, it would be to people who are within a union or bargaining unit that would be the representatives that they're looking at as compared to who knows who.
Thank you for that clarification, and thank you for your testimony. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 383. And I guess we could actually carry this forward to our next hearing because we had it posted for a work session, and that would avoid having to repost it if we do get the fiscal back. Yes, so why don't we carry it, the work session, which...
Wednesday.
So I'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 719. And Jeremy, please tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 719 establishes the Urban Growth Boundary Expansion Area Revolving Loan Fund. It authorizes the state treasurer to issue $50 million in lottery bonds. It directs that monies raised from the sale of bonds be deposited in the fund. It directs that monies in the fund be continuously appropriated to the Economic and Community Development Department for no interest loans to local governments for infrastructure improvements in designated urban growth boundary areas. It limits repayment by the local government of loan to revenues raised inside the urban growth boundary expansion area. It authorizes the Economic and Community Development Department to secure repayment of the amounts borrowed. It authorizes the state of Oregon to withhold any monies due to a borrower in default. and it declares an emergency effective July 1, 2009. The bill has no revenue impact. We do not have a fiscal on the bill, and we did receive today a Dash 1 amendment, which we may be able to have a presentation on from our witnesses.
Okay, thank you. And we now have the chief sponsors in front of us. So thank you. Welcome, Senator Manus Anderson. Welcome again to our committee, and Senator Starr for the first time. So please go ahead and tell us about
this
bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Lori Manus Anderson, representing Gresham, Trout, Dalewood Village, and Fairview. This concept is not new. This idea has been put forth to the legislature before, and it's actually gathering steam as more and more entities throughout the state see the value of this. It came to fruition basically because in Gresham, they extended the urban growth boundary to include a new area. Springwater is a new entity that we would like to develop. But Gresham has a very low tax base, and it is very hard to get funds. With a revolving loan fund, this would set up a loan to the cities to at least get the infrastructure in place. We've seen that with other development in our area that we were able to put a street in, and then all of the, it's an economic development issue because a street was put in very near my place and said, why are you putting a street into nowhere? But once we had the street in, we have now a wonderful development, a lot of businesses coming to the area. Gresham has not been able to do that, and actually talking with other entities in the Deschutes area, and I'm sure Senator Starr's area, many of the jurisdictions do not have the funds to start. And we feel this would be a very boon to economic development.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the state senator from Western Washington County, representing the communities of Hillsborough, North Plains, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. I'm coming to you in support of Senate Bill 719. As Senator Mona Sanderson talked about, what this does is it provides a tool for local governments to move forward with development of land that's brought into the urban growth boundary. In Washington County, we are in a situation where the urban growth boundary has been expanded, but as the county looks at, and the expansion is not in a city, but it's in unincorporated Washington County. And as the county looks at the possibilities of developing that expansion area, the identified cost to provide infrastructure to that new area of the hopefully developed county is somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 to $600 million. To require the developers solely to upfront those costs is difficult, to say the least. And what this potential tool would be to help to underwrite some of the initial infrastructure so that you can jumpstart that development. This is a loan process program, not one where we're basically giving money out of the state coffers, but a would set up a revolving loan account, not unlike what we have currently at OECDD and Water and Sewer for the revolving loan funds that they have. This, though, would be specific to urban growth boundary expansions. It's important for the Portland metropolitan area on the east side of the big urban growth boundary situation that we're faced with, but also on the west side. And as you look at the cities and the jurisdictions requesting this bill, the folks in Central Oregon are facing similar situations. Recognize that we're in tough economic times in this building, trying to deal with budget issues. But if you look at the long-term opportunity that this this bill and the tools that would be provided here, ultimately it provides significant return on that investment. Clearly, the money would be repaid back to this loan, but it would generate significant economic opportunities throughout the state of Oregon, thereby helping to jumpstart our economy. And I think it's good public policy. Would urge your movement on the bill and moving it forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
And committee, just one more thing. If you look at Section 2, it's this is separate and distinct from the general fund, and we would be looking at Oregon State Lotteries to pay debt service on lottery bonds. This is an economic development issue, so that's another thing for the committee to consider, and there'll be more people here to go into more detail.
There are experts in the room, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm confident that there are, and we'll. That would sounds like you might like us to reserve some of our more technical questions for them. But are there questions for the senators? Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moss Anderson, you and I have had many conversations about this, and I want to kind of bring up to the committee conversations you and I have had about some land use decisions that are made where we have jobs and industry that pay very high tax base into communities in one jurisdiction, but the houses that do not have as high a tax base but have a lot of the infrastructure draw in another jurisdiction, such as Gresham, and I have jurisdictions like that in my district. Talk about some of the, in essence, these are statewide policies that are put out there, and yet the infrastructure burdens fall on communities such as ours. And I don't know if you could expand on that a little bit about
the
taxes.
I'd rather have the experts to cite those examples.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you both
for introducing
the bill. And next we will call Ron Papstorf and looks like Jim McCarley.
I guess I need to improve my
Macaulay.
Oh, yeah, I got a letter from my city.
Good afternoon, and whichever of you wants to go first, please.
Thank you,
go
Chair
ahead.
Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Papstorf for the city of Gresham. Dangerous being called a technical expert, but we'll do our best today. Would like to thank Senator Moniz Anderson and Senator Starr for their testimony and for introducing the bill. It's important to note, I think, at the outset that this is not just a City of Gresham issue. This is a statewide issue, I think evidenced by the wide variety of folks that are also supporting the bill, some of which you'll hear from today. Including all areas of the state, the Central Oregon Cities Organization, Clackamas County, City of Wilsonville, Thousand Friends of Oregon, the Home Builders Association. All of us recognize the dire need for these types of strategic investments in these particular areas, the urban growth boundary expansion areas, where the urban growth boundary has been expanded. A local government is charged with the duty to plan for that area. There's an expectation that those areas will develop within some reasonable amount of time. This very focused approach puts some reality, I think, behind those land use decisions and gives some certainty that we will be true to those regional land use decisions. This is focused on a very specific cash flow issue that's fairly unique to urban growth boundary expansion areas, where in our case we went through a lengthy planning process for two urban growth boundary expansion areas in cooperation with other governments, with the property owners, with the community, developed a land use and infrastructure plan that met those community needs, adopted financing mechanisms that rely on systems development charges to pay for that infrastructure, and yet those areas have rural infrastructure in place that is not capable of supporting any type of urban development. And we don't collect the SDCs to pay for the urban infrastructure until development actually happens. So we're in this catch-22 situation. We believe that this kind of break in that cash flow problem that we face will really help us make some initial infrastructure investments that allow us to allow the first increments of development to happen. Then we start the cascading effect. We collect the SDCs. We repay the principal on the loans. And then we've got a cash flow in place that we can continue to make investments in the infrastructure and continue to be true to the expectations of our community to actually implement the urban growth boundary expansion areas. We believe this tool is very important in terms of the need, again, to put some reality behind those land use decisions, that this planned urban development activity is critical to creating local jobs as well as property tax revenue to help us pay for critical urban services like police and fire, and that the state benefits from both the construction jobs associated with these infrastructure investments but the long-term jobs that are created in these urban growth boundary expansions. Scenarios. Again, John Chandler's in another hearing this afternoon that conflicted with this hearing, but he did want me to express to the committee the Home Builders Association support for the bill. Others that I've mentioned, and there I know are other folks that have submitted testimony, including the Special Districts Association and some other folks that I think are planning on testifying today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County, Deputy Government Affairs Manager. I, too, want to start out with just a thanks and appreciation for Senators Mullins-Anderson and Senator George, as well as Senator Starr, for sponsoring this bill. This has got a significant value for the county. As the Senator suggested in part of his comments about unincorporated Washington County, we as well have many challenges that local cities have in terms of dealing with urban growth boundary expansion and coming up with a financial tool or at least a package of tools that helps move forward with development. And this is potentially one of those toolbox items that would be very valuable in terms of the long run. I have a different hat this session than what I had back in 07, where I was working for Portland Metro Home Builder Association. So I bring part of that, at least past experience, with some of the challenges that builders and developers have as they look at urban growth boundary expansion and some of the difficulties of coming up with a financial package and the need to look beyond what we've got in place at this point in time. And that's part of where Senate Bill 719 comes into play, part of where these lottery funds would be extremely valuable in providing part of that kick in the pants, so to speak, to help at least initiate some of the needs for how we move forward with financing these areas in the future. I'm more than happy to answer any questions with that.
And did one of you intend to talk about these Dash 1 amendments?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. The Dash 1 amendments came from some discussions with the Treasurer's Office. They are technical in nature. The Treasurer's Office has looked at, my understanding, all of the lottery bond-related bills that have been introduced this session. They worked with Legislative Council to come up with some standard language that clarifies that DAS actually is the bond issuing agent, that DAS has the ability to recover their issuance costs associated with lottery bonds. So basically, technical fixes to the bonding language part of the bill.
Okay, Senator Mullins-Anderson.
One of the things that this legislature is wants to be very focused on is jobs, and you just briefly touched upon it, but I consider this a jobs bill, and so would you just touch on the about jobs and how this will create jobs?
Yeah. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Mullins-Anderson, thanks for the question. Using just one local example, the Springwater area was one of two urban growth boundary expansion areas adjacent to Gresham. That area was added to the urban growth boundary by Metro in 2002. Its primary purpose was industrial land supply, which the region is very short of. It's about 1,500 acres in size. Through the planning process, there's about 900 acres or so that is primarily focused on industrial and employment, office and research and development types of uses. The projection is that at build out, that land has the capacity to accommodate about 18,000 jobs at build out. So a significant amount of opportunity there, if only we can make some investments in infrastructure to make that area available for development. Our experience in working with industrial developers is that, unlike residential developers, they tend to want to locate in areas that are fully served. They have tend to have a very critical time to market decision making process, where once they make a siting decision, they really need to be up and running and selling product in a very short time frame, and aren't in a position to wait for the design and in installation of infrastructure necessary to serve that land. So they want to be in areas where infrastructure is already in place and readily available to accommodate them.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Having been involved for the last 4 years with the City of Bend's UGB expansion of approximately 6,000 acres, I'm also well aware that bringing this infrastructure is going to be costly. $50 million isn't very much. I understand the revolving fund will grow, but so is there going to be caps on the initial $50 million as to how much goes to which communities?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, at this point we haven't anticipated those types of caps, and I think the intent behind the concept isn't to fund all of the infrastructure necessary to serve each of these urban growth boundary expansion areas. It's to make some critical initial investments in infrastructure that allows us to open up some areas within the expansion area for development. And then once we get the development ball rolling, then we're collecting systems development charges that can pay back the principal on the loans and be reinvested in other infrastructure investments to kind of to grow the area that's available for development.
Follow-up. Go ahead.
Thank you for that. But the question I have then is, let's say Gresham wants to develop, Bend wants to develop. Obviously, they're going to compete. So that's what I'm saying. Has there been consideration on how much a cap would be to a specific area? Because they all have the same need.
Senator Telfer, no, there hasn't been, and we haven't had, as kind of a group of advocates for this concept, had a conversation about setting caps. I think there's an expectation that we're all going to be reasonable, that there really are a set of infrastructure investments kind of in those UGB expansion areas that isn't the full amount of the cost. For instance, I think the full amount of the infrastructure cost to fully build out the Springwater area is $250 million. We're not looking for help in funding $250 million worth of infrastructure. We're looking for some help to make $5 to $10 million worth of infrastructure investment that will open up, you know, 50-100 acres of land to development that we can get started.
Yes, Senator Pozanski.
Madam Chair, I do want to follow up on what Senator Telfer says. I mean, I'm looking at the bill. It looks like ECDD is the one that's going to oversee it. And it seems to me there's got to be some type of either rulemaking or something that's going to put some, call it sideboards, because I could see where if this gets established, whoever might be, quote, unquote, shovel ready now could go in and say, we want more than just $5 or $10 million. And so it seems to me that there needs to be some type of assurance that this isn't going to be a fund that's going to be used only once a year, because it's tapped out. And so can you help us with that as to what the concepts are? I understand from your perspective, but how do we get this from a policy point to into the executive branch for administration purposes?
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. Senator Brzezinski, I think that's an excellent point. I think certainly through the development of the loan program through rule at the department level is a really good place to wrestle through some of those issues about the sideboards around the program, what types of criteria for loans, the sizes of loans, certainly the repayment schedules.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, Senator.
And that it would be nice even to have DASC come forward at some point to see if they would need more direction on what the intent of the bill is, because at least my intent was certainly not to have $50 million going to one entity. And if we need to clarify that in the bill, then I think the points that the good senators to my left said are appropriate to look at.
And we will not, this bill is just posted for public hearing today, and we can certainly get some additional testimony before we are ready to go to a work session. So we'll make sure we have answers to all of those questions. And I don't see any other questions right now for you. So
thank you
very much for your testimony. And next we have Jack Isselman. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Isselman. I'm appearing today on behalf of the City of Hillsborough. And we also commend Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Starr for their introduction of this legislation. We support it for the reasons that you've heard earlier today. Infrastructure finance presents a manifest challenge for communities throughout the state of Oregon. We think this bill potentially offers an elegant, at least partial, solution that allows the type of scalability that's been described for infrastructure financing. If I could address Senator Telfer and Senator Brzezinski's questions about the administration of the fund, I can offer some reassurance from my prior experience at OECDD as the deputy director there. The enabling legislation that you have before you is similar in most respects to several of the revolving loan funds that are already on the books for economic development activities at the department. And then I can attest that underlying those and corresponding with those is a whole heap of OARs that delimit the program. So if you want, obviously, specific restrictions, you can put those into law. There'll be an appropriation that goes on here, too, so the budget note's also at your disposal. But we support the program. We think it is an innovative way to get at this problem, and we'd encourage the committee's full support. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Senator Mona Sanders?
Thank you. How would this affect our bond rating?
I don't know. We better get the treasurer up here for that.
I think that's an important thing us to understand.
Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Mona Sanderson, as Senator Telfer said, $50 million, not a substantial sum of money in the grand scheme of things in terms of our bonding. Obviously, anytime you issue new indebtedness, that has a potential impact on your bond rating. But I think at this level, and presumably you'll be analyzing this in conjunction with other bonding authority that you have in an aggregate amount, and be making decisions within those limits.
And I think you're right. We do need to get probably somebody from the Treasurer's office to answer that question, but it also occurs to me that though this bill does not currently have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, I'm pretty certain it needs to go there. So I think that would be the action that would happen here.
Even though this is not general fund?
Well, there are a lot of bills that have not appropriated general fund.
They have to give authorization for the money.
I think so.
Thank you.
We'll check on that. But okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here today who wants to testify?
Coming out of the woodwork.
Oh, man.
That question
wait a
back.
Second.
You should have just brought the hammer down.
I'm expecting a lot of dittos, dittos, dittos.
Yeah. Okay, well, look at this crowd. Okay, if you could please identify yourself for the record.
I'll be first and most brief. For the record, I'm Doug Riggs. We have the Central Oregon Cities organization, the nine cities surrounding Bend, including cities as small as Culver and Maupin and as big as Bend. So we have quite a diversity of UGB expansions and economic development potential in Central Oregon. And I will say, if I could, just echo the comments that Senator Mona Sanderson made, which is really we view this as economic development, job creation. And although it may be a big city that has a large need, you know, Gresham or a Bend, for a lot of money, in some cases, and I'll give you an example, Sisters could
apply for $500,000 to $1 million and open up an area that could be used for economic development purposes. And small towns especially are being particularly hard hit by the economic recession. Unemployment in Crook County right now is 14.9%. We expect that to go to 18%. I think Jefferson County, I just heard this morning, 1 in 4 residents in Jefferson County is on food stamps. So you're talking rural areas, you're talking small cities. Cities do not have the ability right now either to do the planning or to be able to pay for infrastructure development. And so a program like this, if it were available today, might give them the opportunity to open up areas for economic development, bring in companies from outside of the state if the economy begins to recover, and begin to create jobs to fill the jobs that we've lost in the last few years. So we think this is a good idea. $50 million is not enough. It's not sufficient, but it is necessary, and we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go
Senator
ahead.
Rosenbaum, Greg, and members of the committee, Greg Leo from the city of Wilsonville. We double in size approximately every 10 years, as is in our written testimony, and we expect that trend will continue as the urban growth boundary expands. You'll note that tomorrow the urban growth report will come out from Metro, which Randy may want to talk about, but it will be a shock for many, I think, to see how many houses. It could be a range from 224,000 to 301,000. I mean, that's a lot of houses. Wilsonville has unfortunately had two, and it's kind of a euphemistic term here, but public facility strategies in place where we literally had moratoriums where we could not build because we did not, first of all, have water, and we had to build the water plant to meet that need, and then secondly, didn't have the road capacity and critical arterials where it was a matter of years before we could actually get the public financing together. So this bill is needed. It's an important bill. It is orderly. It provides cities the money they need when they need it to provide the facilities that we need. And thank the committee for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. We're the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. As I believe you know, we are responsible for much of the planning in the region, at least at the regional level, and we have responsibility, the Metro Council has responsibility for setting the urban growth boundary. So we're obviously very involved in the process that this bill would address. As you know, or as you may have heard over the last week or so, we've released some population forecasts that once again make it clear that we're going to have a huge amount of population growth in the Portland metropolitan area over the next 20 years. And last year, we undertook an infrastructure analysis, an assessment of regional infrastructure needs that came up with some kind of shocking numbers about what the cost will be of serving those million people that are going to come over the next 20 years. The numbers were in the range of $27 to $41 billion for the infrastructure just to serve the growth. If we have no growth, we expect the infrastructure needs just for replacing our existing and crumbling infrastructure to be somewhere in the range of $10 billion. So it's a big, big issue. And we're focusing at Metro much more on this issue than we have in the past. We've gone so far as to change the name of our planning department to the Department of Planning and Development because we realize that you can't just plan for growth, but you have to actually do something to make it happen the way that the people expect. This measure addresses the bill before you today addresses one slice of the problem that we face. Certainly, the part that has to do with urban growth boundary expansion areas. And I just wanted to get on the record that my council is also very concerned about developing sources of finance for areas, for all areas that are expected to accommodate growth, not just expansion areas, because in the metro region we've designated centers and corridors throughout the region that are expected to accommodate growth, employment areas that are in the urban growth boundary, not necessarily in a recent expansion area. And so I just wanted to get on the record that the council supports Senate Bill 719, but would be even more supportive if it were even more broadly applicable to all areas that are expected to accommodate growth. And I think I can stop there and see if there are any questions.
Okay, questions for this panel. Yes, Senator Munnis-Anderson.
I think we, thank you, Madam Chair, we're limited to expansion areas because those are usually the entities that don't have the infrastructure around it already to go forward, and it was to sort of narrow the bill. But you're absolutely right. There is a need all across the board, but I think there's a greater need on the expansion areas.
And Senator Prasansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just counting up the numbers here, we got Wilsonville, we got Hillsborough, we got Gresham, and potentially nine cities in the Central Oregon. So now we're about $4 million each.
Very good. Yes, Senator George.
We don't get any, I guess.
you get the extra two there.
We don't build the infrastructure. We don't own it, and we don't build it, so it's okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to kind of echo the comments Doug said and Randy both said on this issue. This is an issue of statewide importance, and it does come to the legislature because these are policy decisions made through our land use laws that have impact. And I think Randy made a reference to small cities, or Doug made a comment, small cities and the ramifications. I have a city in my jurisdiction of Gaston, and there's 300 units going into this little teensy town because people are leapfrogging for affordable housing outside of Forest Grove and leapfrogging out to Gaston. So Gaston all of a sudden has one development request for 300 units, which is going to more than double the size of their city. They spent every dime they had in reserves just doing the planning for that and completely bankrupt the city just to deal with planning for development that wouldn't happen if we weren't making decisions at the state level. And I just want to say that I think you're right. This is a bigger statewide issue than $50 million, but at least it's a step in the right direction with our first step. So, comment.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. And my comment on the capping was because of towns like Gaston, who may not be able to compete with, you know, some of these Wilsonvilles and Metro, I mean, I want to be able to have a level playing field so that, you know, the Sisters of Oregon can compete with Wilsonville, Gresham, and all the other cities. So that's why I'm looking for some sort of equalizing ability.
Joe Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, yes, and by administrative rule, I think that's how you'd put some sideboards on it. I think you'd find a way to prioritize where the money would go, and I think that's a reasonable way to approach it.
Follow up.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Therefore, my concern.
Yeah.
We're not doing the rules. We're giving the money. And yes. So I just want to make sure the rules follow the money.
Thank you.
The intent, at least.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excellent comments. And looks like you've answered all the questions for the moment.
Thank you.
We do have some written testimony from 1,000 Friends of Oregon. And was that it?
Madam Chair, we have two letters from Special Districts Association of Oregon and from 1,000 Friends, both of whom generally support the legislation, and we do have a copy of the -1 amendments in your packet.
Right. Okay, so members, we are only posted for a public hearing today, but I'm confident we'll be bringing this bill back, and we will ask the Treasurer's Office to come and talk about the effect on the state's bond rating, as well as, I think, there were questions for Department of Administrative Services. So, and we're awaiting the fiscal, and we'll clarify the referral issue with the Senate President's Office as well. So, with nothing further to come before us today, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 719, and we are adjourned.